Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Parker Romaine.
And I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc.
Since 2015, we've been recapping great documentaries with our amazing guests from TV, film, comedy, and more.
And today we talk with award-winning director Jeff Fierzig about his work, including the documentaries Half Japanese, The Band That Would Be King, The Devil and Daniel Johnston, which won top documentary directing honors at the 2005 Sundance Film Festival and was recently voted the best music documentary of the 21st century.
Plus, author the J.T. Leroy story and his upcoming documentary called The Legendary Stardust Cowboy. And now, here's Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. Hey, Paco. Hey, George. How you doing, man?
Thanks so much for being on the show. Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely.
And you've got a little, like, sparkly stardust in the background, which I kind of like.
You're right.
I kind of actually thought that's what it was. I thought you were going to be like, this is some sort of weird branding. Or
no, it's like, you know, there's method acting. This is method editing today.
It's great. Yeah, so. It's a good sparkly background for a podcast so that everyone will know about instantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do it. We have high production value here on SupDoc. We like to just talk about images. Man, thank you for joining us. I have been wanting to talk to you for so long. You have made a few of my absolute favorite documentaries.
That's very nice of you.
I still remember the first time seeing The Band That Would Be King. And even though I have I know some of the fairs. I grew up in Coldwater, Michigan.
They're from Michigan originally, although everyone thinks Jad and David Fair of Half Japanese are from Maryland, but they're actually from Michigan.
Yeah. And the little tiny town that they grew up in, I grew up in as well, and I actually took bass lessons from their brother Pete for a while.
Now we're getting really deep here.
Yeah, so it's a deep cut. So they're kind of, you know, legendary in our little neck of the woods in Michigan. And I always had heard about Half Japanese growing up. And so I still remember watching that doc for the first time and just being like, what the hell is going on? This is awesome. Like, who are these guys, man? You know, like, and like, I remember that. I got a lot of stuff to say about this, but I also like growing up with that kind of like noise, do it yourself noise band kind of stuff where everyone's like we play every instrument because it's not really about knowing the notes in theory. It's about, like, you know, like David says in your doc, like, the low end is low, the high end is high, the skinny strings are high, and the fat strings are low.
I think that's in the Minutemen documentary, too. It's just like the fat strings make the low sounds, the skinny strings make the high sounds. So like the same logic applies.
It'd be more true.
Do you play an instrument, Jeff?
I did not. When I was making the Half Jap film, this would be 1990, I guess, I started that film. It came out in 93. I have a question. Where did you see the film? Was it a DVD or in a theater?
I saw it. It must have been a theater. I think I saw it at the theater in Ann Arbor. Yeah, because I don't remember having a DVD, seeing a DVD. I think I saw it once in the theater in Ann Arbor with some friends.
Oh, I'm glad you saw it in the theater because, you know, in 93... that was a 16-millimeter film. So it was very difficult, yet still possible, to do a theatrical release of an independent film, although very, very, very difficult to pull off. But we did it. And what was fun, for me anyway, you know, coming out of punk rock and everything and DIY, was taking this 16-millimeter print and schlepping it all over the country. And in many cities, we would fly. We couldn't afford to fly the whole band, so we would usually get the promoter or the theater to pay for one ticket. That would be Jad, and then we did it Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry style. We'd find a pickup band. We'd find local band who we, you know, in the underground, and we put a band together in any city to back Jad that night. So it would be the film first, 90 minutes. We pretty much sold out every city, you know, the Music Box, great theaters in Chicago. L.A. had an incredible screening at the New Art. We did San Francisco up in the Hate. We did, I'm forgetting the name of the famous theater up there, but that was a great screening. But Jad would, you know, the credits would roll, and then, you know, we're in a theater, and boom, like he came right off the screen. There's Jad Fair.
Nice.
And some, you know, you can call them half Japanese because whoever was in the band at that point for the night was drafted in as half Japanese. And, you know, they didn't rehearse. Maybe they rehearsed for 10 minutes in the dressing room. And that's what we did. We put this on, and it was just so fun and homespun. And nobody does that anymore. Like,
no.
So, you know, with films, you know, with bands, obviously, you tour.
Right.
So that was great. So I would fly out, Jad would fly out, we'd meet in a city, we'd find a band of some friends, boom, and we did this. And it was a blast. And that to me was indie film right there. That was independent film. That was just like, we're gonna do this. We're gonna make this film for literally $75,000 on 60mm. Now 60mm, the problem with 60mm is that very few theaters have projectors.
Yeah,
I could
yeah.
still show the damn thing. So that was an effort in itself to find a theater that could have us. And then, you know, there was no publicists or promoters, so we would have to work each city. Postcards, posters, flyers, like it was a band coming to town. Mm-hmm. And you would be very surprised, like, what, you know, obviously there used to be a thriving art paper in every city. They don't exist anymore.
Right.
There was then, and we often got the main film reviews, great big photos, a lot of ink, and we somehow sold these theaters out and put on a great show with Jad, and it was a blast. So that was kind of like my trial by fire, my first indie feature doc.
Jeff, were you at, so you actually traveled to most of the screen, you brought the reels with you to the screenings and basically flew around or drove around with those? Because I was at the Berkeley one.
Sure.
We're bringing all this up. I'm like, that was going to be my story. Is I did see this at the UC Theater in Berkeley, and I remember Jad playing, and I kind of like knew one of the people in the pickup band, and like I had heard of, I think I'd heard half Japanese or Jad solo on like the Kill Rockstars compilation. I think that's all I knew about it, and so it was kind of educational to me. But then, like watching this again, I'm realizing how many things in this film must have really totally impacted me in the early 90s, because I ended up working in independent record labels for a long time.
Oh, really?
Putting out records. And then, like, I actually worked at Alternative Tentacles, who had done a bunch of records with Jad. And I think one of my first week on the job, I think I got an email from Jad, like an AOL email or something. And I never talked to him in person, except one time in Austin. I actually did randomly. He just was at a thing. And I think I knew who he was, and I didn't really say anything. But I was at that screening where they played, and it was like pretty memorable. I think I have a photo of it somewhere. I will have to like try and scan it by the time this episode comes out. Because I don't remember if you did a Q&A or anything at that.
Well, we did Q&A's pretty much everywhere, and you know, I do recall. Now I think the San Francisco screening was one of the first screenings, and Jello Biafra was definitely there. He came up after because he had put out Jad, or right. Half Japanese, on a great compilation on Alternative Tentacles called, I think it was called Let Them All Eat Jelly Beans.
Let Them Eat Jelly Beans, yeah. That's one.
Yeah, so he was an early booster of Half Japanese.
It was probably the Red Vic if it was in the Hate, right?
It was the Red Vic.
Nice.
And the other great memorable part of that night was that Eddie Shaw from the great band The Monks showed up with his monk outfit. And that was very special for me.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the Red Vic, RIP, that was like one of my favorite like independent movie places to go. Just like four blocks from my house, and Like that was like a rite of passage to have their calendar on your wall, to have that Red Vic calendar. So how did you hear about Half Japanese? Like, what was the catalyst to contacting them and making that doc?
Well, you know, I was since I was very, very young, an early music geek, you know, following all kinds of things before there was ever such a thing as punk, of course. And then, then punk hit, and that was a revelation to me. But I was also a little young to participate. And then I got to college, and I was very, very active in college radio in Trenton, New Jersey.
Okay.
And Princeton, WPRB. Princeton.
WPRB, yeah.
So I was a DJ on both stations and very much a part of the American indie underground scene. I don't use the word alternative ever. But anyway, so, you know, I found out about Half Jap through college radio in the early 80s. Obviously, they'd been around since like 77. They had one of the very, very first independently released punk records. You know, they were right after Patti Smith and a few others. But they were, you know, people don't remember this at all, but they were it in the underground for a little while. And when Charmed Life came out, the record that the film largely focuses on, which is, I would say, their masterpiece, you know, everybody wanted to collaborate with Jad Fair, from Sonic Youth to Yola Tango, you name it. Everybody, like, you know, Jad Fair was it, and Half Japanese were it, and they deserved it. And they have so many other great records. So, anyway, basically, there was no such thing as indie doc at that time. It was 1990. It was dead as a doornail. MTV had ruined the world with just dumb music videos, selling garbage to people. You know, even underground artists, very few of them had these music videos, something I still don't love. Anyway, so I was like, you know, nobody's doing this. Nobody's documenting the great music of our time like Pennebaker and the Maisels had done, you know, pointing camera at Dylan and the Stones and Jimi Hendrix and whatever, the great music of their era. But nobody was rolling 16-millimeter film on our underground scene. There was some great artists out there. And I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to do it. So I did. And I put my money where my mouth was, and I blew about $75,000 shooting this, which was a lot of money at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It probably cost me $90,000 in the end, because I didn't realize, you asked about those prints. So we had to, like, you know, make – I had, like, five prints made, and each print is a bunch of reels. And they had these shippers. They cost a fortune to ship.
Yep.
And every time you send them out, especially 16-millimeter – they would get scratched and ruined because the theater owners, you know, the 60 millimeter projectors were not maintained. So they're just getting scratched and ruined. And you're just like, I just spent $1,000 on a print. It was a nightmare. And the sound sucks on 60 millimeter. It's optical.
Okay.
You know, and that was a bummer, because on the DVD, you at least get a great stereo mix. Film does sound good. But in the theater, it's far from great listening to that experience on an optical print. But that's what we did. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
So, you know.
I think it's like watching that. I just watched it again two nights ago, and it's such a nice time capsule of that era. I mean, like you said, you started filming in 90, it came out in 93. And it's so funny to watch, like, it reminded me of like how much we all hated MTV. I kind of forgot. You know, and there's so much hatred about MTV in that doc, you know, Penn Jillette, and everybody's just like, fuck MTV. And I was like, oh, that's right. We all thought it was going to just ruin and end everything.
And it kind of did.
Especially once it started getting into like reality TV programming, you know, like when, you remember The Real World and all that shit, like when that stuff.
Oh, I didn't watch that stuff, and I heard of it. Of course.
Yeah.
Like I most culture in the last 30 years, I'm only really aware of because they're on billboards when I drive.
Oh yeah.
I don't actually watch it or take part in it.
That's one of my questions too, related to, like, so there was a DVD version of band that would be King Half Japanese, but
one of the first DVDs, I will tell you.
Oh really?
That was a nightmare to have that created.
Did you work with the company?
Well, sort of, yeah. There was a company that wanted to put it out, and I licensed them, the title, and we had the thing authored, and it was, and there's a lot of good bonus material and whatever. Mm-hmm. It was, all these companies, it's like indie labels.
Yeah.
Some of them had the best of intentions, but boy, good luck getting paid.
This is like I was talking about Plexifilm a few years ago, and that was like kind of the similar concept. I'm like, this is exactly what an indie label. And now there's something called like Vinegar. There's like a horror movie DVD, Blu-ray kind of reissue craze happening because a lot of that stuff never got its DVD release proper. So they're just going straight to Blu-ray. But as far as streaming services go, I was going to ask you this, and my theory was it's not on a streaming service probably because of music rights licensing, but then reason could it's not for that. It's just because you're not interested in streaming services. Is that
here's the deal. All right. Number one, the good news is this. I own the rights to the film, and it's all cleared, and it's great. It is on a streaming service. It's on Vimeo, and people can pay. Mm-hmm. But, many years ago when YouTube showed up, I'm with Debbie Harry, and I'm with the guy from Camper Von Beethoven, that lawyer.
Siegel, yeah.
Yeah, I it's just a giant copyright theft. For now a company that's owned by Google. So I'm not putting up my intellectual property on their site so they can monetize it and pay me nothing. I'm not going to do it. Right now you can rent that film on Vimeo. I can't remember what it's, I'm charging it $7 or $10, whatever it is. And maybe a few people rent it every month. You know what? It comes to me, not them.
Yeah.
So screw them. So,
worth it. No rent it. Rent the film. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, filmmakers, artists, musicians, nobody deserves the intellectual theft that's taken place. It's a bank robbery. What's happened with, I don't subscribe to Spotify, but I love Bandcamp. Money needs to go to the artist, so you're not going to have this stuff.
So Vimeo, there's no pop-up ad in the middle of watching it on Vimeo when you pay for it. Exactly.
No, you rent it. Yeah. It's on the internet. You can find it. You Google it up. There it is. And if you want to watch it, great, but it's not going to be for free on YouTube. That was the big nightmare. Like, people started taking the film and excerpting it into like 10 parts on YouTube. And YouTube, of course, doesn't have a clearance department because they're hiding behind the Digital Millennium copyright. That's how they get around all this. Like, HBO isn't one day going to take the title, the film, half Japanese, or The Devil and Daniel Johnston, they're not going to just throw it up there. They're going to get sued. They don't have the rights to it. Mm-hmm. So how YouTube conned the world that they're allowed to do this because other people would take your intellectual property and upload it, and there it was, and they're like, oh, we don't know how it got there. That's just the biggest bullshit scam that's ever taken place. It's a bank robbery. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I had to like write emails to their department, some form thing, for each of the 10 excerpts that somebody uploaded of the film to say, I'm the intellectual property owner, take this down. Mm-hmm. And then I had to like prove that I am the intellectual property right owner. Now the onus is on me. Next thing I know, I've put 48 hours into this thing that I, to take it down. So it's a giant effort to fight these people.
Yeah, that's horrible.
I'd rather be making films. It's a lot of work. but I got it taken down. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, and that was great, but it was a pain in the ass,
Yeah, they don't want to make it easy for people like you to have to contact them and get a hold of them and take something down. They want to make it as hard as possible.
Oh, they do.
I bought tickets to go see Pink Floyd a year ago through Ticketmaster, and because the show is postponed because of COVID, I can't get a fucking refund.
Right, because it might just reschedule. It's just like infinitely rescheduled.
Yeah. And I'm
I have ticket. I had tickets for the Mummies at Zebulon in Atwater Village.
Yeah.
And you know what? I like Zebulon. I like to support that club.
I like
nobody offered me my Mummies money when COVID hit.
Yeah.
They weren't looking to get your Mummies money back. Yeah. I mean, this is fucking Ticketmaster though. I mean, it's not like they're a fledgling ticket production company or something. It's fucking Ticketmaster and Pink Floyd. They could both just give me my $300 back if they just maybe get on the phone with Roger Waters or something. I don't know. But it's like they make it so fucking hard to contact them. Mm-hmm. There's no link or anything.
No, I smell class action suit.
Yeah. I think there was one in Arizona. I think people tried to like get, and I think they capitulated and gave them their ticket money back. But
oh, I did want to like going back to the initial touring form that you did for that first film. As I was talking to a filmmaker who did a similar, he called it like four walling. I don't know if that's the same business deal you
had.
Yeah,
that's the same
which
thing.
Is a lot of what promoters would do. I think even the early, you know, because when the Weinsteins were like concert promoters and they switched to film distribution, I don't know if they brought like some of the music side of that into the theatrical side. But yeah, so it would be you're not fronting the money. It's a door split, right? Is that what four walling is? Or you're not fronting the money?
Four walling is when you actually rent the theater yourself. Which mm-hmm. I really admire for people who did it. I can't say we technically four-walled because it's not true. Mm-hmm. So basically what happened was there's a great theater in New York called Film Forum. I love it.
Yeah.
Great theater. I always supported it. They took the film as an official release to premiere the film for 2 weeks in New York, and that was great. So we couldn't put the band in Film Forum. That didn't work with how they operate there. But we had down the block the Knitting Factory, which was a great club.
Yeah, yeah.
So we booked a half Japanese alumni weekend, which means every formation of half Japanese down to the original power duo of Jad and David, who, of course, I was too young to see. They all played it over the weekend, and Yola Tango played under a different name, and you know, they've always been big supporters of Jad, and I think Ira played sax, you know, on some of those parts with John Dreyfuss. It was something else. It was, and we basically tried to bring the fun everywhere we went, to every city, you know, and it was fun. And I you know, you can't really do it anymore because no one wants to do it. Yeah. But it's, people should think about that, you know, from the indie world, because that's where it's at.
Well, I also just watching this again, I was just remembering how much these other talking head voices are so integral to narrating it, like Byron Coley and Gerard Cosloy. I'm like, I feel like they were as big a part of that film as anything. And it's also like you're documenting, like what Paca was saying, you're documenting this sort of like infrastructure that existed in this sort of pre-internet kind of period of underground music. And like that is all changed now. Cause I'm thinking now, like someone could go make a SoundCloud, sort of like the cassette underground now, like what is the equivalent? I guess it's SoundCloud or Bandcamp, but like, it's like the distribution channels are completely different. And like the whole system that you're talking about are very different from that period of the early 90s to now. But I think it's good to have the entire context that half Japanese existed in. And that's kind of what I got out of it, watching it again as well.
Well, you know, it's funny that was important to me. Now, and I got to be honest with you, you just said the word talking heads. To me, that's a first film. It's not the band is better than the film, in my opinion. All right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the talking heads go on interminably, in my opinion, as well. And
but they're entertaining. Gerard Cosloy and Bernard.
No, they're incredibly.
Like, there should be a Byron Coley documentary. I'm pretty sure.
No, there's no doubt. Byron and Gerard are so funny, and so is Penn Jillette. Yeah. They're all funny, but if I was going to redo the film today, it would be a very different film. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I was very, very young.
But it's shot so well. Everything looks great. Yeah. Your cinematography is awesome.
I appreciate that. But honestly, I was very young and learning. Mm-hmm. And it was a first effort. And it's not, I don't feel like the film is a home run by any stretch of the imagination. But you got to start somewhere. You know, even
it fits the topic of like just start it with does. What you have, your limitations.
Exactly. That's what
and
I
just
was,
if you have an idea, it, that the, beats the, technique. Ideas beat the technique.
The film feels punk rock and do it yourself. And then that's kind of what you're covering. It's like a perfect marriage between the two.
Well, I really appreciate that. But I'm telling you, I had to make that film in order to ever make The Devil and Daniel Johnson.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Right.
I learned so much and I made so many mistakes on it. And that's how I learned.
It seemed like it's pretty easy to play a guitar because, you know, once you know the science of it, the high notes, the little skinny ones make high sounds. Big fat ones make low sounds. And then if you go on the part of the guitar near where you pluck it, that makes high sounds, and down at the other end, like, then you got it mastered. That's all you got to know. Oh, and if you want it to be fast, play fast. And if you want to go slow, go slow. That's all there is to it. It's that easy to play guitar. Some people worry about chords and stuff. You know, and that's all right, too. you know, there's all kinds of music in the world. You know, you might want to learn some other stuff if you're doing that kind of music. For what we do, for what I was doing, you know, that was the beauty of it. You can learn it that first day.
Well, yeah, you do need chords in order to plug the guitar in, but
yeah,
that's pretty much it.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So basically what happened was I make this film for out of my own money. I was directing horrible, evil TV commercials to make a living and, you know, burgers and chicken, and I would sell cars and political candidates and,
yeah,
I mean, you know, you name it, like Viagra. I did it all.
Yeah.
And I would take that money, and just like what Penn Jillette did with his Miami Vice money in the movie, he wanted to do something good and honorable with that filthy lucre, right? That evil money. So he put out Half Japanese Records. I decided I'm going to take this money and I'm going to put it into this indie film, and that's what I'm going to do. So I did it. So I end up in Berlin. And this is a fun story and a true story. So it's 93. I'm at the Berlin Film Festival. I got my wet print, 16 millimeter, schlepping on the plane. And I meet a guy named Henry Rosenthal. And he's an indie producer. And he produced a bunch of Greg Araki films, John Jost, John Mortescue, Modfuck Explosion.
Oh, yeah,
he was in a,
yeah, yeah.
He was in a one of the first punk bands of all time, Crime, from San Francisco. So Henry Rosenthal, he had another name. He was Hank Rank. And he had just been covered by Sonic Youth on the record Evil. Hotwire My Heart.
Hotwire My Heart.
Prime cover. Great song. Anyway, so I'm in Berlin. We do the screening. I'm walking out the door, and there's a guy who does not look like the guy in Crime, by the way. Very straight-laced looking guy at this time, and he's got tears in his eyes, and he takes my hand. He says, "Did you make this film?" I said, yes, I did." He said, "You made this film just for me," and that was my introduction to Henry Rosenthal, and we met and we went to a cafe and we talked all about, believe it or not, Daniel Johnston, because Daniel Johnston was still like not on the radar screen of anybody in the underground. He was just emerging. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think he had just collaborated with Jad Fair on that incredible album, It's Spooky, which has just been reissued.
Great album, yeah.
I think so, too. Yeah, it's a great collaboration. I just did liner notes for the vinyl reissue. But anyway, we talked about that day in 93, that one day we're going to make the Daniel Johnston film, the Daniel Johnston documentary, and then we became pals, and I guess it was 2000 we started making The Devil and Daniel Johnston, and then it took a long time. So that was 5 years. It came out in 2005.
Okay.
So without making Half Jap, The Devil never would have happened.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then they're kind of a part of – Half Japanese is a part of The Devil and Daniel Johnston. I mean, there's footage of them.
Well, Jad and David Fair are in the film because they're in the story. They're baked into Daniel's journey, the collaboration of that album. And then, of course, the trip to Uniontown, Maryland, where Half Japanese were living at the time, where Daniel records the album and then goes home and goes crazy and throws the old lady out the window and gets arrested and all this horrible stuff happened. And that was all, you know, they were there and they were filming. David Fair, I should say, was filming or videotaping Daniel. So he's the one videotaping what was called My Dinner with Daniel, their riff on My Dinner with Andre. And also that great Don't Play Cards with Satan on the organ, that's David Fair. So David Fair, he was like, I'm trying to think what we would call it, the great movement with Lars von Trier, the...
Dogma 95.
David was before Dogma 95. These guys are true visionaries. Before there was a Dogma 95, David Fair was doing it first.
Oh, wow. So he's filming when Daniel's crying and playing that and singing that on the organ? Oh, wow.
Yeah. They were witnesses.
Holy crap. That's such a heavy scene, too.
So heavy. Doesn't get heavier, right?
No, it does not. That's another doc that changed my life. Like, I have a few docs in my doc-loving adulthood that have changed my trajectory, and that, obviously, the Devil and Daniel Johnston was one of them. After seeing that doc, I was like, what is happening? What is happening? I mean, because I remember when he was big in the 90s when, you know, Kurt Cobain had the
Let's put big in quotation marks.
Good point. I mean, for people like us, he was, like after seeing that doc, that's another one I saw in the theater. And like the story of him and his dad in the airplane and, you know, all of that. It's like you can't. This stuff, the truth is stranger than fiction, is never more true than in situations like that. And then like the creative madness. I mean, like, I feel like that kind of runs through some of your docs. Is like the creative madness of some people or the mad creativity of people, you know? Like, do you look for that, or is that just something that unfolds, it seems, with your subjects?
It'd be tough to say I was looking for it.
Yeah, but, sure.
You know, I just love great stories. And, you know, I always thought Daniel, first and foremost, was an incredible story.
Yeah.
Yes, he's a great artist, no doubt, visually and, you know, his music. No, I mean, absolutely. But I remember back in, oh my God, it was probably I got out of college in 86 or 85 when I was doing college radio, you know, Daniel and his cassettes, you know, emerged in the underground. That's a very tiny little world back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we have no internet, you know. We have fanzines.
Right.
And I remember my buddy from PRB, Ken Kacken, who went on to run Homestead Records.
Oh, okay.
You know, he turned me on to Daniel, and I just, you know, in the back of a fanzine, there was Stress Records, a little tiny ad. And I think each cassette might have been $3, perhaps, you know.
Yeah.
I think I ordered the whole thing, you know, all of them. Mm-hmm. Just send me them all. You know, I want every cassette. And there was, like, I think 8 cassettes at that point. So everybody only thinks about Hi, How Are You? But every one of those cassettes is incredible. And they're all very different. So I ordered those tapes and, you know, obviously the primitive artwork, which now was tattooed on everybody's body and on, I don't know, Van sneakers and Supreme t-shirts now. That was not the case. But people didn't take it seriously. But what I loved at the moment when I heard those tapes, obviously the songs of Unrequited Love and how open he was about documenting his own mental illness, I loved it. You know, he taped his mom yelling at him between the songs. And, you know, at that same moment, I was probably reading A Confederacy of Dunces.
Right.
And probably at the same exact moment, fell in love with Scorsese, the King of Comedy. And I was like, oh, my, and it just a light bulb went off. I was like, this is the real version of that. This is Daniel in a basement in West Virginia. Yeah. And yelling and screaming back and forth with the mom. And I was like, that's a movie. I said to myself, this is 85. Wow. So I was so captivated by his self-documentation, his audio verite that he was putting out there. This was out there. So at the same time, maybe you had a great article. There was a fanzine by Mike McGonigal at the time called Chemical Imbalance, ironically. Mm-hmm. Daniel got the cover. So you had an in-depth, multiple-page article with art and photos, and you're reading this thing, and you're just like, whoa. At the same time, unlike the Minutemen or half Japanese or you name it, you know, Husker Du, they didn't, Daniel didn't tour. So that now we're thirsty. We want this as there's a myth. Like, is it, is it all, you know, is the girl in all these hundreds of songs, Lori, does she even exist? The librarian, did he make her up? You know?
Yeah.
So he built this incredible myth. And then there was this one, you know, voice of communication, like, who's the Minister of Information for Public Enemy? Professor Griff? Professor Griff,
right? I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, he was the Minister of Information. Well, Daniel had Tartikoff, the little Jewish guy in Austin, Texas, Stress Records. Now, that's pretty funny calling it Stress Records. Daniel, I'm sure, caused a lot of stress.
Right? I would imagine.
So it was really this guy, this little Jewish guy, like, and I became his pen pal. And he's sending out, you know, all these tapes, and you get a little letter, and you get a little, you get a drib and a drab of information, and you're just dying for more, because it basically built a myth, and we couldn't see him. He couldn't come and he couldn't tour because he was often in the mental hospital, and that just made it even crazier. Wow. So then, like, you know, the Village Voice, and we had a great paper at the time, that was better than the Voice, actually, the New York Press, or the New York Free Press, which it was originally called. They started covering Daniel. So all of a sudden, when he crashed a plane or when he, you know, threw an old lady out a window, you know, it was like, what is going on? It was all playing out sort of before our eyes, not in real time,
right,
like now on the internet, but we got the information pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And then thank God for WFMU, you know, the greatest,
yes,
in my opinion, free-form, independent college radio station in America. Now, they're not really a college radio station, but they were at Uppsala College in Jersey transmitting through there. But anyway, regardless, they were the huge boosters. So all of a sudden, Tartikoff, you know, he sort of got a hold of the New York underground scene, which was Shimmy Disc Records with the producer Kramer, Chad Fair and Half Japanese, Sonic Youth, and Mo Tucker of the Velvet Underground. And by basically networking through just those four points of light, and if you, and you could arguably throw in the Butthole Surfers in Texas, with those five points of light, Daniel took over the world. It was that simple, at least in the underground world.
Wow.
And that was, I watched it all play out before my eyes. It was fascinating. So I was keeping a folder from 1985 on this guy.
Wow.
Obviously, I had all the
clippings.
Yeah. You name it, I would keep it. And I would just keep a folder because I, you know, he was like a fine wine. There was no movie yet. Even in 95 or whatever year, you know, that horrible moment happened with alternative rock. You know, when that happened, there was no movie yet. But finally, you know, in 2000, he finally emerged in New York City, and it's a legendary show. He shows up at the Knitting Factory. Now, no one's ever seen him. So now we got decades of lusting for this guy, right? And he sells out the Knitting Factory, standing room only, and he shows up. Well, I think he shows up at the first concert. He loses his notebook and doesn't even play. So that's like a disaster. And he comes back a few months later, and he plays.
Yeah.
Now he's, you know, he's diabetic. He's obese. He doesn't look like that beautiful kid that we saw photos of at the, you know, who worked at McDonald's.
Right.
And, but there's that voice. And he still had his faculties. He still could play the guitar at this point in time in 2000. And I swear to God, there was not a dry eye in the house at the Knitting Factory. People were weeping to hear these songs that were, once again, still underground songs.
Yeah.
But when he sang and he was shaking and he's singing True Love Will Find You in the End, and you're looking at this guy realizing he's never going to get true love for himself, I mean, the tragedy of that just was overwhelming for anyone at that show. I called Henry that night. I was like, oh, my God, Daniel Johnston has a third act. It's time to start making this movie. So, you know, we didn't know if it was even possible. We both threw $50,000 down on the table. We were willing to lose it, just like with Half Jap.
Yeah.
And let's just go down to Texas and see what happens. We'll do an exploratory surgery. And that's what we did. And we went down there and we slept in a Motel 8 in Waller, Texas. And I got to tell you, there is nothing in Waller, Texas.
Right.
There's one place to eat, this one Mexican joint that's not a fast food place. And that's it. And so you're at the Motel 8, and you're on this crazy schedule with this family, because Daniel lives with the family.
Did you contact, who'd you contact first, Daniel or his parents? Or
through the stress guy? Or
yeah, I was in town directing a TV commercial for I don't remember what, and Daniel was playing a show in Austin, and I met Tartikoff, my friend, Jeff Tartikoff, and we went back, well, there was no backstage. We're outside in the back of the club. Daniel always is out by dumpsters smoking cigarettes. So we were by a dumpster. There's a lot of dumpsters in this story. And Tartikoff.
That's the poll quote. Yeah.
I know.
That's awesome. I know. Every good
Mulholland Drive and the Devil and Daniel Johnston.
Yeah. Pretty much. So anyway, I was introduced to Daniel. And he remembered that basically Jad vouched for me.
Yeah.
Because Jad's a friend of his, and I made the half-Japanese film.
Right.
That was good enough for Daniel, and he just said, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do it. And that was it. And he agreed, and we were on our way. So
that's amazing. You would think someone like Daniel Johnston would be camera shy, but he's not. It's kind of an interesting thing, because he's... Or was he? I guess I should just ask you. Was he camera shy? Did you have to coerce him a lot to, like, open up at all?
Well, you probably don't remember, but Daniel is not interviewed once in The Devil and Daniel Johnston. It's all sleight of hand.
Oh.
I did interview Daniel for about 5 days, and we threw it in the garbage. It was horrible.
Oh. My head just exploded. Nobody could see my face, but yeah. You're right about
I mean, he's fully present in the film because I took all the audio diaries, all the audio tapes, and that with the cassettes, and that is Daniel's internal monologue, and then you fully get Daniel. Much better than those interviews, I assure you. Daniel was like talking to Brian Wilson by the time I got to him. It was like some old guy telling war stories. It was horrible. It was a film that nobody ever would have wanted to see.
Oh.
I certainly didn't want to see it. And I didn't want to make it, so we didn't know this, of course. So we just it actually became the best thing that ever happened. So you just kind of roll with it, and the materials that I got, the found cassettes. We're talking hundreds of cassettes, not just music, but the guy's taping everything.
Yeah,
that was like so much more interesting to make a film out of. So that's what I did.
Huh. Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you kind of have the same thing with the half Japanese doc, where you have David Fair's, they had a bunch of home movies and things too.
There was David had some home movies. I used them. I wish I had more, but there were it was only a little bit. Yeah, the half Japanese doc needs so many more photos. Like that's what's missing. Oh. I was young and I didn't know what I was doing, and I was enamored with early Errol Morris, and I still love Errol.
Sure.
But, back then, his interminably long talking heads was like very in vogue. People don't remember this. And I thought that was cool too. So, the talking heads didn't seem as long when we were making that film, but now they feel really long. And, like in Devil, the heads are up as minimally as small as possible, and it's all covered up by archive and, recreations and all kinds of fun things. But, people rag all the time to this day. It's one of the worst things ever. People, I hate talking head documentaries. Well, there's a reason. So,
right.
But logging all of those cassette tapes must have been a crazy chore. You did all the log, because like there's probably one cassette that's like him singing and telling a story and his mom yelling at him. And then you have to log all of that stuff and digitize it too, I imagine. You're digitizing stuff.
Yeah, we digitized it all, and I was responsible. But at first, that was the most fun ever. I spent months with headphones on, on my laptop, manually transcribing Microsoft Word with a little QuickTime window of like, stop. Because if I sent it out for transcription, yeah, which I could have done, I wouldn't have felt the emotion of the tapes. Right. So I just did it, and then I just did my own little system. Like, I would bold or... This is a 5-star tape. You know, and then I would just decide, oh, this would be in the movie. This will go in the movie. And, you know,
it's metadata tagging. You're metadata tagging, but for like emotional resonance and like where it could go. Yeah.
Totally. And those tapes are what make the film, in my opinion. So someone had to do it.
So did you already have an idea? Did you script it out beforehand, or did you just let it unravel while you're hanging out with Daniel Johnston? What was like, what was the play there?
Or how much hanging out was there actually?
Oh, there was quite a... Well, I will answer both your questions. Let's do the hanging out first. Okay. It's probably more fun to talk about. Yeah, so Daniel, when you get there, you know, he lives with mom and dad. They're elderly, all right? Mm-hmm. And he is just a pain in the ass and uncooperative. And he sleeps all day long, mm-hmm, and he stays up all night long drawing hundreds of drawings, writing songs. Every day is Groundhog's Day. All right, the movie Ground. I'm not exaggerating. So, you know, he'll rise maybe 4 in the afternoon. Now he's all groggy. Now he needs to eat. So you got to drive him, and you go to the same Mexican restaurant. And then he takes this giant iced tea. And, you know, at the diner, those glass and silver sugar dispensers?
Yes.
He unscrews the top. Now, we could be having a really lovely conversation. You know, he loves to talk about the things that he's obsessed with, whether it's Marvel Comics and Jack Kirby, or perhaps, you know, he knows more about the making of the film King Kong than anyone on Earth. Things like that. Or the Beatles. Anyway, you're having a great conversation, hanging out with your pal Daniel, and then he unscrews the sugar dispenser, and he takes it, and we're talking the whole thing, whoa, 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 fills this giant iced teacup, and now he guzzles this thing down. And it's all over his shirt, and I'm there with my tiny documentary crew, and then I'm telling you, 5 seconds later, boom, his head hits the diner table, and he's out like a light. It's from the sugar high.
Diabetes,
and,
yeah.
And then we just, eat for about a half hour, and then Dan, whoop, he's back up. Okay, now we're not done yet. We got to go, of course, to the Five and Dime store, because he's got to buy stickers, okay? So we go get the stickers. Oh, now it's time to go over. I think it's called it's not Dairy Queen, the other one. Sonic. He likes Sonic. They've got like a Slurpee slushy thing kind of thing.
Yes.
So he has to have one of those. So we do that. Now it's time to maybe get some filming done. So, you know, he's happy to play music, happy to do art. That's all good. The interviews, you know, as we came to learn, that was like pulling teeth. And it was just, you know, we wasted a lot of time and a lot of money. And it didn't work out, and that's fine. So now to dovetail back to your question, you know, I knew, of course, from the folder and the stories and the arc and the plane crashes and the this and the that, there was definitely a 3-act movie to be made.
Right.
And I built a wall of cards like any screenwriter would, and that's how I did. But then it would jiggle it around and play with it and screw around, and just took a long time to get it right, you know?
Yeah.
But, it's tough to say there was a pre-imagined movie, it evolved. And then we would edit a long time. Then we would go back and shoot what we felt where we were missing and things like that. So,
right. Have you watched it recently? Do you rewatch your films?
I'll be honest with you. I did not watch the film for many, many, many years. And then when Daniel passed about pretty much a year ago, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, then I watched it because I flew up to San Fran. They did somebody put on like an impromptu screening in a theater, and they invited me up and to do a Q&A and whatever. And I flew up, which was great. And I love San Fran. Henry's up there, the producer. So we went and watched it together, Henry and I, for the first time in, God, it had to be a decade.
Yeah.
Maybe more. And we had a great time with the audience, and it was fantastic. And there's a lot of good laughs in that film.
Oh, that's so awesome.
We loved it. For me, it was like, well, I hadn't seen it in so long. Mm-hmm. And then we remembered every little thing, you know, every whatever, every emotional scene, every laugh scene, you know, there it was. So
yeah,
it seems to have held up pretty well at that point.
Right. Yeah. That's got to be an interesting thing, like revisiting. Do you ever just wish you could have another couple days? I mean, it sounds like with the half Japanese doc, you're like, I'd like to go back in and re-edit some of that stuff.
When I retire, I'm telling you, I'm going to go back.
Remaster.
Really?
Well, you know, it's funny. Like a lot of great photos have come out, and I've seen things have come up on that film. And if I got my hands on it and threw it in an edit room for 3 or 4 months, I would have some fun. It would be a tighter film. There's some repetitive lines in the film. Don't get me wrong. I'm really proud of it, but it's a first film. Like I went and looked at I've seen Scorsese's early documentaries, and it took a long time before Taxi Driver showed up.
Right.
You know, and have you seen Italian American or the one where his friend? One's about his mom making sauce. And it's great in that his mom is making sauce, but is it a great film? Yeah, I would argue it's probably not a great film.
Right.
You know, and then there's another one where his friend is like in a hot tub, and the friend's not that interesting. So, but then again, he had to make those films to get better.
My name is Daniel Johnson. This is the name of my tape, and it's Hi, How Are You? And I was having a nervous breakdown when I recorded it.
Try to remember, but my feelings can't
know. He's a skinny little kid. Fairly demented, and he said, I just wanted to give you my tape. And I put it on the tape player, and it just blew my mind.
There's really nothing to even compare it to. It goes way beyond Dylan's basement recordings, any other body of work that I can think of.
You start off hearing this noise, then eventually you hear the Beatles. You hear the whole symphony.
But it was undeniable that something was dreadfully wrong with him.
He was thin as a rail and losing weight.
Was completely delusional. He was hospitalized almost immediately. He was obsessed with the devil and Satan. He became so obsessed that it was all he could talk about.
This is Daniel Johnston speaking from a mental hospital. They tell me I'm crazy here.
Ooh, out come the demons.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Jeff, did you go to school? You were in school in New Jersey, or where'd you go to school? And did you study film, or did you just come to film out of being a music fan?
Well, I was at Trenton State College, and I was once again doing college radio, but not just DJing. I was cutting tape as the production director.
Okay.
I also had a column writing for the paper, so it was journalism. There was no such thing as film, and nobody went to film school that I knew in Jersey.
Right.
It wasn't even a term I'd heard of in high school. I'm sure NYU existed and UCLA existed, the people I went knew did. No one ever imagined going to film school or talked about it. Mm-hmm. So then, I was very involved doing that. But we had, cable TV and a TV station. I was very much a part of that. So I was learning all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't like about cinema at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got very, very lucky. Where basically Jarmusch shows up with Stranger Than Paradise, as well as Down by Law.
Mm-hmm.
I took a train into the city, And I saw them both in the same day, out of order, unfortunately. I saw Down by Law first. Great film, by the way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then I went to a different theater and saw Stranger Than, because he was on the cover of the Village Voice. So it was, he was an independent hero. That's the key word, independent. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to lose that here in, you know, in our new culture with streaming. But anyway, he inspired me. And then I saw Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It at a theater in D.C. I was visiting a friend at Georgetown. And I was like, wow, I really want to get, I want to do this, you know, and that, it just inspired me. When you, and that dovetailed with DIY American indie punk rock, the self-publication of fanzines and putting out your own records. It just made all the sense in the world. And, you know, in the interviews with Jarmusch back then in The Voice, what was so badass was that he went out of his way to say that he owned his negatives. That was so cool.
Yeah.
You know, and he had a financier. I think it was like this German guy named Otto Grokenberger. And, you know, it was a very different scene. And, like, you know, he just did it, you know? And I think we all read that he got, you know, extra film off of Wim Wenders to get it made. Like, the struggle was part of the story. Obviously, these are great films, and they stand up as great films. But there was a struggle behind those films. Like, we read about the Coen brothers' first film, you know, getting financed by a bunch of, like, Jewish dentists in Minnesota. Like, that's who's responsible for the Coen brothers. You know, if it wasn't for those visionary dentists writing that check, we wouldn't have the Coen brothers. You know,
Can you imagine?
And Blood Simple was such a great film. So that all kind of coalesced with, you know, SST and Homestead Records and the Minutemen and Black Flag and Husker Du and, you know, all this incredible independent art and music just bombing us at the time. The Replacements, Twin Tone out of Minnesota. You know, it was just so inspiring that you just wanted to do something. You wanted to be a part of it, you know?
Were you at all excited or influenced by Michael Moore when Roger and Me came out? Was that something you were like, hey, look, this guy's fucking doing it. You know, he was a journalist, you know, with like the Flint Weekly or whatever.
Yeah.
I'll be totally straight with you. I saw Roger and Me also at Film Forum. I loved it. I loved it because it was so funny.
Yeah.
You know, the aesthetics of that film and his other films don't do much for me, but that's fine. He is a fun, great storyteller. Obviously, you know, he's a shit stirrer. I love that.
Yes.
You know, he's the fly in the ointment. When we need that guy, you know? So, yeah, that film was great. I mean, it didn't inspire me as you know, aesthetically by any stretch of the imagination. But, boy, did I enjoy it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Because I feel like that came out in, like, docs kind of all of a sudden people are like, well, we can watch documentaries again or something because it's, like, it's fun. It was entertaining, you know?
No doubt. Yeah. And then, you know, honestly, like, there's many different camps. I wish we had a new word for it because, you know, there's like a whole category of very necessary docs that might as well be, you know, a Common Dream article that I read already, you know. And that's great. It's fine. But, you know, then there's docs that are cinematic, you know, and, you know, and more novelistic and, you know, things like that. And I just don't think they're in the same boat, you know.
Well, we kind of have a breakdown of the kind of ideal films we like to talk about on this show are weird Americana. And I think everything you've done sort of touches into that realm as well. Like those three films, I think, are all kind of like they're very American at their core, I think, in some ways, like Daniel and Half Japanese and even the Laura Albert film feels very like they're like, you know, American stories. So, yeah, I think that's one. But, yeah, like the journalism, the kind of alt-weekly journalism or like new journalism, I think that's like that's in a weird way. Something like Vice maybe kind of is like was another generation of that. And now, yeah, I think that stuff's still happening. As you grew up with like sort of this alternative media infrastructure of like college radio, alt-weeklies, punk rock. And then now, like, a lot of those things are just dying off or that they're becoming more and more cult. They're getting more and more siloed into their own thing. Like, all weeklies are pretty much gone away. Like, if we look at what's happened to the LA Weekly now, it's, like, pretty, pretty awful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's so sad. Because what was great about those all weeklies, and I became friends with a lot of these writers, there was great writing taking place. And obviously somebody was paying those writers, and they made a living, and they were able to eat and pay rent. But these were great writers, great thinkers, and they had great personalities, and they were all very different in style. And that was really healthy for the cinema culture, the book culture, the literature culture, and, of course, the music culture. You know, it was a whole industry that supported a lot of people, really.
Yeah, and like the finding weird nonfiction stories, like an Alt Weekly would have been the go-to to like get an idea for a documentary probably like 10 years ago or something, you know.
It was one of the places. Yeah. I mean, you know, Vanity Fair would cough up a pretty damn good article here and there. Rolling Stone also did some great work, you know, even though I don't like Rolling Stone for a long time now, but their investigative journalism was fantastic. And they supported a lot of great journalism. So, you know, obviously there needs to be new writers and new young people doing this kind of work, and they need to get paid or they can't do it. And if the internet can support that, that would be fantastic. So it's not to me about whether it's on a piece of paper or on the internet, but someone needs to pay for this writing, this thinking, and nurture these ideas and these stories, you know? You know, whether it's weird Americana or serious journalism, whatever, it's all important. You know?
How do you, what do you feel like is the role of mentorship? Like, did you feel like you had mentors for film other than like in the general, like DIY culture kind of mentors? And do you feel like do you have people that look up to you as a mentor now as a filmmaker? You know, both sides of that question, I guess.
Well, you know, the mentors were, they didn't really exist, but they were in my mind. There was, I would say, heroes are more interesting. It's like I had real heroes, you know, and that was everything. And I, you know, when I read like Dylan's Chronicles, what I loved about that book so much was that he just outs himself, you know, how he loved Tiny Tim and the rest of Gorgeous George or Jimmy Rogers, the country artist. You know, he had real heroes. Obviously, Woody Guthrie, we all know that narrative, right? But that's important, you know, or Ramblin' Jack Elliott, you know? So I had heroes. It was that simple. And, you know, they might have been musical heroes, not necessarily documentary heroes, you know? But, you know, Kubrick and Woody Allen are as big of heroes to me as, you know, Mike Watt and the Minutemen and Dee Boone getting in a van. You know, those are all heroes. Those all, and Tom Wolfe, the man in the white suit with New Journalism. Those are real heroes to me to make me want to just try to do this work, you know, and not be ashamed of it like the TV commercials.
And then how did you find out about what got you into the J.T. Leroy story? I mean, and making that documentary, was that something that you did you hear about J.T. Leroy beforehand?
There's a folder of those. Yeah.
Or was it the ensuing outing that got you interested?
A little of both. So basically, you know, back to the Alt Weeklies. Here we go. New York Free Press used to publish J.T. Leroy. Now, I was an avid reader of New York Free Press. So, you know, I didn't clock J.T. Leroy as an author of those books at that point in time. I absolutely read these celebrity puff pieces because Laura Albert, J.T. Leroy, was heavily working the Alt Weekly journalism world to pay her bills. So she would write these celebrity puff pieces, whether it was about, you know, her interactions with Gus Van Sant or whatever it was. So I was reading these things and I enjoyed them, and there was just one other writer, you know, in that Alt Weekly. And that was that. I never thought more of it, and I totally missed those books and the brouhaha and the outing that had happened. In real time, I had no idea. I was oblivious. I guess I was making devil at that time or something. You know, I just go into these rabbit holes and don't come out for years. Yeah. That's fine. So anyway, so now devil was over, and I had made The Real Rocky. I don't know if you saw that film. That's my ESPN 30 for 30. Talk about Americana.
Yeah.
Chuck Wepner, awesome. The Bayonne Bleeder. But anyway, so I finished that, and then my buddy Paul Cullum, who used to be an Alt Weekly cover writer for the LA Weekly, great writer, great journalist. I was fishing for some ideas, and he's like, you know, you ought to check this J.T. Leroy story out. And I was like, okay. So, you know, there was, I think, at least three great pieces written, like an extensive Vanity Fair expose. This is a while now, so Salon.com probably had a giant piece. New York Times certainly had something, and there was probably one other, and I read it all, and what was funny was he was in a very different camp. You know, J.T. Leroy was a pariah and was excommunicated from the literary world. And he, you know, people would say that J.T. didn't write the books and all kinds of stuff was floating around and that other authors wrote the books for J.T. Leroy, you know, like Dennis Cooper, things like that. Anyway, so he was probably of that camp. And I read those articles and I said to him, you know, I think there's a great movie here. And what's interesting is that in all these incredible pieces, it generated this expose of outing J.T. Leroy generated an incredible amount of ink.
Right.
You know, in prominent publications and really great writing, by the way. And every piece was different. But nobody had spoken to Laura Albert, J.T. Leroy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I want to hear her side of the story.
Yeah, right. Oops. Why don't we talk to her?
Yeah. Because nobody, well, there's a reason nobody talked to her because she, she was like, you know, curled up in a ball somewhere for a couple of years.
How frightening. I mean, how fucking frightening would that be? Like, we all suffer from imposter syndrome as creatives, but like to, you know, put it out there and dress it up and have this theatrical production basically, and then have people be like, whoop, the curtain's open. Now we're backstage and it's all fraud. I mean, that, I don't even know how you come out of that, you know?
Well, yeah, I was fascinated with every aspect. And of course, I was fascinated with what we didn't know, you know, the untold story. Like, who is this person? Why did it happen? There has to be a great reason for this.
Yeah.
So I reached out to her. It was not easy. And I found her in San Francisco. And she watched Evelyn Daniel Johnson. And, you know, she emailed back and she said, you know, everybody from Hollywood has been knocking on my door for like 3 years, including some very prominent people. But you know what? You're Jewish and you're punk rock. I'm making this film with you.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that's just how it works.
Yeah. There's so much. You packed in so much information into that doc.
Oh, yeah.
Did you think about making it into a series, a part, like a docuseries at all? Or?
Well, no. And at the time, the docuseries wasn't even like a lexicon.
Yeah.
We'll reserve my comment for documentary. But
that'll be a second interview.
Yeah.
Patreon.
Yeah. No, but seriously, that's a dense film.
It's, a lot happens.
It's super dense. It's and there's like you must have left some stuff out that you wanted to get in there that you couldn't. It was anything you can remember that didn't make it. That
there was so many great scenes. First of all, it was like, you know, I thought Daniel had the biggest archive of self-documentation that's ever been found.
Oh, boy.
With all those tapes.
Yeah.
Right.
Hundreds of, I mean, seriously, in the films and the videos. I mean, I literally, I thought I had the world's record on that one. I didn't know what Laura had.
Oh my God.
I mean, when we went to San Francisco and pulled up a minivan.
Holy shit.
To take, you know, all of her tapes and all of her stuff. And I mean, the apartment was stacked, boxes, every room. You couldn't walk through the place. Yeah. And we had to go back to the airport and return the minivan and get a real full-size van because it never would have got back to Los Angeles.
Holy shit.
We couldn't fit it in a minivan. That was absurd for me to think a minivan was going to take the J.T. Leroy archive and in one trip. It wasn't going to happen.
Wow.
So that was a monster. But what a gift, right? To have that
positive hoarding from the most positive hoarder outcome you can have.
Yeah. So now I'm back on the headphones again for another few years because that's what I do. I spend my life on headphones in the dark listening to tape.
To other people.
Transcribing.
Speaking.
Yeah. And that's what happened.
At least they're labeled, right? They seem to she's labeled who's talking at least on those. Yeah.
True. Yeah. No, she's very, you know, she's a great storyteller.
Oh my, yeah, she is. She's got such a creative mind. And there seems to like, what is it about people who I think like they don't quite have a hold on reality? So they record reality to like almost remind themselves of what reality is. Is that, is that what that is? I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
I've thought about that. I actually think it's much more primal. I think at least for Daniel and maybe Laura, all this taping your whole life or documenting your whole life, or I mean, it's all documentation, whatever the medium, right? I just think it's to validate that you're actually alive.
Whoa.
Oh, whoa. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there is, I guess, some detachment issues, and it helps perhaps to hear it again, or just hear your voices in your life, you know, out loud, perhaps. Wow, that's interesting.
Now, I'll tell you one thing about that. I don't believe for one second it was humanly possible for either of those people to ever go back and listen or watch it, because it's not humanly possible to do it. I did it for them, and if they died, nobody ever would have.
Yeah.
But you were talking the man hours alone and the focus to go through a lot of, like, not important stuff to get to some of the good stuff.
Right.
That's a lot of dredging, I'm panning for gold.
Right. Well, how do you, Mike, it's like, how do you know what's gold and what's not when you're listening to that? Doesn't it just become a cacophony of sound, or do you, like, how do you know when you're like, this is gold, this is going in?
Yeah, it's all feel. It's like you're making hopefully an emotional journey on these films, right? It's not just information. And if it emotionally resonates, whether it's a story point or not, if it emotionally resonates and it has layers and it's thematically hitting you, it goes in a certain pile, and then you try to work it into the narrative, you know?
Did you do the interviews before the logging of the audio tapes or after? Or kind of contiguous, yeah.
I mean, I did like, once the film was finally financed, which was not easy. It took like 3.5 years to get that film financed. Wow. So I had the rights to make the story, but nobody wanted to pay for it, which I thought it would be an easier film to get made, to be quite honest, because it had so much media buzz, at the time, and it was largely still an untold story. But regardless, once the film got made, it became like I call it the brain bomb. Like, I just literally hit the couch for like 3 months, 24/7, and slept and just absorbed and read and marked and did whatever I could to just learn what I believe was as much of the stories I could possibly know that was out in the public record, including her private stuff, And then I prepared for the mega interview, which I think we did like 8 days in a row, and that was it. Shit. But she was a good storyteller. But that was a big process. Because she's, she's not simple to work with either. She's very different than Daniel. Sure. She requires, dark chocolate, it's a very specific brand, and certain smoothies, and a nap, and maybe a massage and a rest point, a lot of makeup, you gotta have hair and makeup on this.
Right. You know, yeah.
It's like that. Yeah. There's a lot of, she has to look, good. And I respect that. So we did that all. We did whatever it took to get her through this massive, endless interview of her entire life.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine there's not hair and makeup needed for Daniel.
No, actually, that was a big decision. Like, do you even like neaten up? I mean, you saw that garage he basically lives in.
Right.
It's covered, floor to ceiling with photos and clippings of monsters and the Beatles and things like that. And do you move, a McDonald's wrapper like even an inch? Or is that, going to screw up the integrity of the film?
Right. Yeah.
Those are big decisions,
Yeah. So let's talk about your upcoming doc, The Legendary Stardust Cowboy. How much can you tell us about that?
Well, I could tell you a little bit. The Legendary Stardust Cowboy, I'm assuming most people listening to this podcast, nobody knows who he is, and that's fine. That's by design. I love stories like that.
Right.
So, nobody was running around like Laura Albert trying to get these rights because nobody thinks they're valuable. And that's great because as far as they're concerned, they're not. But I knew they were super valuable. This is like, in my opinion, the last great story we're going to get from what's called like Grail Marcus's The Old Weird America. Okay. This is a gem that's been totally forgotten. And because of his age, you're not going to get more people like this because of the internet's changed everything. Regionality, nobody has stories like this anymore.
Mean his age now?
Yeah, his age now. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what, 70?
72.
Okay.
So Norman Carl Odom is from Lubbock, Texas. And, basically in 1968, he had a great moment. Somehow, he ended up on the counterculture's number one comedy show, Laughing. And there was only three artists, music artists, ever were on Laughing. One was the great, one was Tiny Tim, the great Tiny Tim. The other, believe it or not, was the Holy Modal Rounders.
Oh yeah,
and that's it. And the Ledge, his nickname is the Ledge.
That's it.
That's it. The rest of it was comedy and all those actors and doing skits and things like that. But there was no other music artists. So he had this big moment. And that was the end of it. And he had one hit record, which arguably, or at least I'll argue, is the greatest novelty song of all time, Paralyzed. Now, we have a little website. It's like a teaser website. It has no information on it. It has just maybe two sentences about him and one thing. You can click on Vimeo, not YouTube, and hear Paralyzed. Okay?
Okay.
And everybody should do that. This is the story of the man that recorded Paralyzed. What people might want to know, and it's probably the only detail I'll give out, is there's this character that was pretty famous. He was named Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, yeah.
By a little artist named David Bowie.
A little skinny British man.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
And he created this fictional character for a while, made an incredible album, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, and wrote a bunch of songs about outer space. All pretty great. anyway, he got the idea for this character from the legendary Stardust Cowboy. He took Stardust.
He got it from the British.
He just took out the American part.
Wow. He copped it from the Ledge. Was it so? Did he steal it, or was it an homage, or what's the?
Or is that the question that is answered in your film?
Oh yeah, maybe we can't ask.
I wouldn't call it a steal. I mean, he was inspired.
You know? It was a tip of the hat, if you will.
Absolutely, and then I'm not going to give the whole story away. Many years later, like 30. What year is it, 68? He actually covered the Ledge finally and paid that debt back.
David Bowie did?
Yeah, he covered I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship, produced by the great Tony Visconti, one of David's greatest, earliest producers. Mm-hmm. And he pays that debt back years later. And that's part of the story of the film. It's not the whole story of the film, I assure you. But
interesting.
It's a lovely, lovely little hook there that the Ledge, Norman Carl Odom,
what a name.
Without the legendary Stardust Cowboy, there is no Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, shit. That's fucking awesome.
And that's that.
Okay. Is there footage of him?
It's not a music documentary. There's a lot of music in it, but it's a great story, like Daniel's story, but incredibly different.
Oh, man. So do you have a release date for this? Are you still working on it?
Henry Rosenthal, who produced Devil and Daniel Johnston, is also producing this. He also was a producer on J.T. Leroy. This is our third film together now.
Cool.
And we've been making it for a year. When COVID hit, because it's a largely animated documentary, not fully animated, but mostly, we haven't stopped one day during COVID because it's mostly animated. So it's been, thank God we didn't have to stop. But the film's been in production for almost a year now. Animation is like watching grass grow.
Yeah, right. So it's a slow process.
We might be looking at 2 years from now, to be honest, even though the film's, it's going well. We're editing every day and shooting and, it's been great. But this is one hell of a story. I've never heard a story like it. And that's why I love it. And I didn't know the whole story when I started, to be honest.
How'd you hear about him?
I think it was 85 again, magical year.
Yeah, it was a good year for you.
Yeah, there was a great record that came out, a compilation record called Rockabilly Psychosis and the Garage Disease. And on that record...
Who wouldn't buy that album just from that title alone?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, great title. And on it was the Cramps' first record with Miriam Linna from Kix Records on drums. The great Hazel Atkins, the Haze.
The Hayes,
who I love and adore, and The Ledge with Paralyzed is on that record, and that was 85. That was when the world realized that this guy is still alive, and I was like, what happened? So I got turned on in 85 to that story. Although I didn't I didn't know the story, you know, but now I do.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah. So we're talking Singing Cowboy, Stardust, and Walt Disney's Tinkerbell and Peter Pan. We're talking about Gene Autry and Hollywood Singing Cowboy movies. Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, all this incredible stuff. And then Paralyzed, which you haven't heard yet, which, you know, there's life before Paralyzed and life after Paralyzed, you know, and that's all I got to say. There's a bugle solo that's going to blow your mind in Paralyzed.
Holy shit. That sounds amazing. I wonder if I feel like we should go out listening to Paralyzed. It's
sure.
Can we put that on the podcast? It's on Vimeo, right? It's open to the public.
Of course. Well, of course. Yeah. Listen, just don't play. It's on YouTube too, but I don't want to support them.
Yeah.
Why should they get this half a penny for the stream when when Vimeo can have it?
There you go. Well, that sounds awesome. I can't wait to see that. Hopefully you'll come back and talk to us when that doc comes out, because
I would love that.
It's just from your description alone, I'm like salivating. I'm like, that is right up my alley. That sounds like something that I would love.
Wow.
Especially, and he's still alive, so you're able to interview him?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been fantastic. Norman Carl Odom. And for your listeners, you know, just so you know, we've got every day Instagram. If you go to Legendary Stardust Cowboy Film, you get a great photo of the Ledge every day. And now I got to keep this up for like 2 years now. This is going to be tough. But you get that. You know, and then you know, when you see just the graphics and the clothing design of the cowboy, and it's just going to blow your mind. There's a lot of fashion design in this story. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. Jeff, thank you so much for talking to us.
All right, Paco, George, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And so let's do it. Let's go out listening to a little bit of The Ledge with Paralyzed. And we'll keep our eyes and ears open for this documentary when it comes out. Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure. Jeff. And you, like I said before, you made some of my absolute favorite documentaries. So
thank
you so much.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. Recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel. Our show was engineered by Will Scoville. Our associate producer is Nick Coltis.
Please donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help us in other ways, please share the show with a friend.
Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all those platforms.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
To find out more about my and George's comedy gigs, check out our About Us page on our website.
And SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans. So if you want to advertise, got a film, or opinions you want to share, just hit us up.
We'd love to hear more from you and what you're docking out on. So email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, say something, sure, right back at me, bro.